So as we sit, I encourage you every now and then, if you want to lighten up. We're very much in the habit of sort of being heavy. And then, in my experience, when my body gets heavy, my mind gets heavy. And if my body has a feeling of lightness, my mind tends to be a little lighter. And then the quality of the conversations I have with myself are a little lighter. Because it's about all about conversations, and I'm imagining that some of you are like me, and the heaviest conversations are ones I have with myself. So, to me, one of the most important parts and values of a meditation practice is to make friends with ourselves. And one way to do that is, when I sit, is to actually notice my thoughts instead of just coming back to my breath, taking a moment and being able to go, oh yeah, there it is, and have a moment of kindness. Because my thoughts, even my negative thoughts, are just trying to create security for me. When we work with the leadership embodiment process, we make a distinction between two parts of ourselves. We call one our personality and the other our centered self. So personality is like ego. It's the part of us that's actually trying to create security. And we do that through these strategies. I like to call them control, approval, and safety. And so when I'm in my controlling mind, I'm very judgmental. And when I catch my judgmentalness, now often what I can do is go, oh, right, you're trying to keep me safe. Because when I was a child and I was judgmental, I felt I was right. And if I was right, I could feel safe. I could feel real. And my sense of approval, my neediness, wanting to be respected, liked, appreciated, also trying to keep me safe. When I was a child, I felt if people liked me and respected me, I was safe. So all those things that arise in my mind when I'm thinking, if I can remember, they're just trying to keep me safe. Then I can have a moment of gentleness and kindness toward them before I return to my breath. Or the technique I like is I like to put my thoughts into the space. As you know, the Buddhist rhetoric is everything arises, abides, and dissolves. Well, after 25 years of sitting, it wasn't dissolving. Now I know that they mean many, many lifetimes, but I'm an American. I'm in a hurry. So I had this idea that I could just put the thoughts into the space. And at first I thought I was setting myself free from the thoughts, and then I realized I was setting the thoughts free from me, which I thought was very cute. And they come right back sometimes. Still, there's a moment. There's a gap. And in that gap I can return to my breath, or what I like to use as a reference point is a sense of lightness and softness. And the breath is there too. But I can be concentrating on my breath and have a feeling of heaviness. So by cultivating lightness and softness, my mind begins to relax a little bit, making friends with ourselves, relaxing our mind. Not easy. It's a long-term endeavor. Nonetheless, I think it's very worthwhile to be able to accept ourselves. Because as we begin to accept ourselves, our mind can relax. And then we can relax when other people are annoying. Because I'm sure we all know what we can't relate to and what annoys us in other people is usually what we haven't accepted in ourselves. So mindfulness is such a gift that way. It lets us sit down and get to know ourselves, begin to accept ourselves, relax a little bit. And then we can start to relate to what we call our centered self in the work that I do. And our centered self is the part of us that we experience when we've touched into what we call the zone or the flow state. That's the part of us that recognizes something's coming through us, that we're not doing it, that we're a conduit. And I imagine many of you have been practicing mindfulness for a long time and had glimpses of that, where suddenly everything opens and we're just in a very pure space. We are connected to everything, and we don't have to do it all. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, the interconnectedness. And not only just people, but we're connected to all elements. And all those elements are filled with life force. So when we realize that we're interconnected, we can have a sense of working together instead of separately. But working together and working in the world and trying to do things that matter can be challenging. These days, things can feel a little bit heavy and depressing sometimes out there in the world. And so what I really want to talk about tonight is resilience. How do we cultivate resilience? How do we keep ourselves from feeling depleted, exhausted, frustrated when we're trying to do activities and make a difference in the world? First step is we have to be working with ourselves, that meditation piece where we begin to make friends with ourselves, so we can discover our basic goodness. And then we want to bring some goodness out into the world. We want to be able to make a contribution. And it's not that easy. Sometimes just looking at the headlines, like, ugh, we can start into a bit of a down spiral. And that's when we get heavy. So throughout the day, if I'm not in a meeting face-to-face, I might do hand on top of my head and pop it up. Because when I lighten up, my mind starts to see possibilities. So to me, resilience has two parts. The first part is that idea that I don't have to do it, that it can come through me. I do have to make some effort to get clear about what it is that I want to do, for sure. It's kind of a partnership with the universe, is how I think about it. I have to do my part to have a sense of what are the activities that I want to do, or I'm called to do, or that are put in front of me, either of those. And once I have a sense of that, then my practice is not to try to do it from inside myself, but to let it come through me. And some of you have heard me talk about this before, but on the table there's some new posse cards. I have my posse. Maya Angelou calls it her entourage. The sense that I'm not alone when I'm doing my activities. The sense that I can invite wisdom, compassion, confidence, courage. And the way I invite them is by thinking about archetypes. So when I need more compassion, which I do frequently because I'm quite judgmental, driving is my main challenge. I'm very judgmental when I drive. And the good news is that when I have a judgmental thought, pretty quickly following that, I think of Mother Teresa. She's my archetype for compassion. I studied her and I was very moved by the work that she was doing. And so I think of Mother Teresa, and for a few seconds, sometimes a little bit longer, I suddenly feel a touch of compassion for the other driver. Instead of thinking, what an idiot, I think, oh, be careful. So I don't have to stay in that judgmental place. When I need wisdom, I'll often invite His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche. And when I think about them for a moment, my mind feels like it opens, it expands. Sometimes I'm working on a project and I feel my mind's getting tight, trying to do some writing or do something. And if I think about His Holiness or Rinpoche for a moment, I just feel for a few seconds, everything starts to expand. When I need courage, confidence, I'll often think about Nelson Mandela. Some of you know I have a place in South Africa, and he is definitely one of my heroes. Or I'll think about the founder of Aikido. We call him O-sensei. And for a few seconds, I just feel a little different energy. It doesn't last. And I can do it again. And so that's a way to touch into what I call the centered state. It's our resourceful place. I think of it as outside my skin. My view is that inside my skin is just fundamentally neurotic. I don't mean that in a pathological way. I mean that in a general cultural way. I want control, approval, safety. I struggle with trying to figure out how to control things. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. Some of you have heard me say this before. It's fundamentally my compost. So I'm an avid gardener, and when you grow anything, you have to put compost on the soil. And compost is shit. It's been treated well. And so my shitty little self, when I start to have compassion for it and come to terms with it, gives me compassion and wisdom. When I can relax with myself, the needy part, the mean-spirited part. And when I can accept it and relax with it, it doesn't hold me so tightly. It's there, it's my humanity. And it can be the basis of my wisdom and compassion when I see that it's really trying to keep me safe. Outside my skin is me too. We don't end at the skin. That's just not good science. And that part of me, in my experience, is not as neurotic. That's where the wisdom of Mother, the compassion of Mother Teresa and the wisdom of the Dalai Lama and my other teachers, they hover around me. It's me. It's the bigger me. It's the me that I've glimpsed sometimes in a meditation where everything just starts to get light and opens. And I'm no longer caught in the thoughts. I'm in the moment. I'm not attached to trying to stay safe. I realize I'm going to die, and it's okay. I can relax a little bit with that. So that component of resilience has the sense that I'm connected to something bigger, that I can invite that to come through me, to do my activities. It can be any kind of activity, something around the house, a domestic activity, giving a presentation, gardening. If we wait for a moment and tune in and invite, we can often have a sense of doing something with much less effort. We must tune in. Wait for that pulse, that breeze. And it's like mindfulness, it takes a lot of discipline. Because certainly I am in the habit, and I was educated to believe that I have to do it. No one will do it for me. It's up to me. I'm responsible. I've been taught that I have to self-generate everything. It's just not true. I learned this many years ago when I was practicing Aikido, the Japanese martial art that I do, because I'm small and I'm a woman. No, I'm older. And I have some guys in my Aikido school who are half my age and twice my size. And there's no way I could do it. Just Wendy, this body. I needed to call on the bigger me, the me that appears when I'm in the zone or the flow state. And in doing that, I started wondering, why don't we do this more often? Why do we wait till we're fatigued? You know that feeling you're doing an activity, you begin to fatigue, and then it gets easier? It's called tuning into the zone. But we often don't even think about that until we're struggling. What if we just did it throughout the day? Touched into it. The way I like to trigger it is thinking about it as a breeze. Because we all live in the Bay Area, and everyone here has experienced the breeze for sure. Where I have a place in Cape Town, it's very windy. So my body knows that feeling of a wind at my back. And then I can attribute that wind to archetypes. They're supporting me. Their hands are on my back. And when I do that and I open up and I wait, suddenly whatever activity I'm doing becomes easier. If I'm struggling with writing something, it becomes a little easier. If I get some water, take a break, sit down, think about my dear friend George Leonard, who is a wonderful writer, he wrote many books. Invite George energy to come through me, and sometimes there's a little more creativity that seems to immediately arise. Then there's a second component for me to resilience, to being able to keep up our effort without becoming tired, fatigued, frustrated, feeling depleted, exhausted. And that is connected to the first, and it's not being attached to the outcome. Not being attached to results. Very tricky. Because my personality defines me from the point of view of what I've accomplished. Who I am, my credentials. I do this, I do that. I've done this, I've done that. My centered self is not as attached to the outcome. It has much more sense of being able to really let it come through me, work hard, make the effort in a joyful way. And if it goes south or it gets weird, then it gets to. There's a engineer, Russian engineer from the 1930s, and he had, his name was Polinsky, and he had the Polinsky principles, which I thought were really great. They were try new things, fail at scale. I thought that was a really cool one, fail at scale. So if you try something and you're doing something, we have to succeed. It has to be right. But what if I fail? What if I don't succeed and it's not right? So his advice, which I thought was great, was fail at scale. In other words, don't fail at the level where I lose everything. And the third one was adapt. Go forward in a new way. So try new things. Don't be afraid to try something. Don't be afraid to put ourselves out. Be willing to fail. And if we think, all right, I want to set myself up to fail at scale. Even if I decide I want to take a silent retreat for some days. Maybe I go and after 2 days I start to lose it. And I realize I can't do all 5 days. I tried it. I would have failed at scale. Then I would adapt and say, next time I'm going to do 3 days. Instead of five. So we need to be willing to put our energy into something and work with not being attached to the result. When I do work in organizations or we go out into the world, I often work with my daughter. She's wonderful. She's my partner. And working in organizations is an interesting thing, especially we end up working in tech and biotech organizations for some reason, Silicon Valley. And we always look at each other before we go in to do a piece of work for an organization, and we'll say, it could get weird. And we go, right, it could get weird. And then if it does not go well, we look at each other and we'll say, it got weird. And we can smile at it. It helps us not be so attached to the result, that they have to love us, that they have to think it's great. Sometimes they do. Sometimes it doesn't work. And it's important that we don't tighten up around it, because then I get tired and I feel frustrated. My critic kicks in. So for me, this idea of resilience is something that I think, especially as we get a little bit older, how do we keep that feeling of buoyancy, that feeling of lightness, keep the feeling of possibility alive? The two components that I think are most important, and they have a lot of aspects, that are, let it come through me. Figure out what I want to do, figure out what's important. And when I do the activity, remember, I don't have to do it all myself. I've got a posse, I've got an entourage of inspirational archetypes I can invite to give me energy. And also, I need to check myself constantly, even in my daily sit. Don't be attached to the result. Those of us who've sat for many years know we can go through a period where things start to really smooth out. And then all of a sudden, it can get weird again. And I begin struggling and having dark and mean-spirited thoughts. I get caught up. I'm like, really? After 46 years of sitting, it still happens? Yeah. But it's important that I don't feel like a failure, that I'm not attached to the result of having smooth, calm meditations. Because then I can just keep going. And the mindfulness is a way to make friends with myself. Meditation, I get to sit down and check myself out, see what's up, and be compassionate. And keep coming back to a sense of lightness, sense of softness, allowing my breath just to be. If I'm thinking the universe is breathing me, I don't have to breathe a particular way. I just let it take me. So I'm going to take us through the centering, and then I'm going to open it for some Q&A. So the centering process is inhale, uplift. Exhale, soften our chest. Think of something that makes us smile. Relate to the space around us. It's us. It connects us to everyone and everything. There's space above our heads, space behind us to the sides. There's space inside of our bodies. Our bodies are atoms. They're primarily space. We could soften our shoulders a little bit. And we might even invite an archetype or a quality. This year, my quality is wonder. And I'll just ask myself, what if there was a little more wonder? And I wonder what it would be like to think about Neil deGrasse Tyson, one of my favorite guys. He has this whole spiel on how we're made of stardust. If you have a chance, you can go online and check him out. It's great. He's a physics guy, and he's funny and bright. And he talks about how everything came from the stars, and our planet was formed when we were formed. He says, and we're stardust. When I think about that, it makes me feel lighter and smile a little bit. And then the short version of the centering, some of you have heard this, but it came from my Aikido teacher many years ago, who was frustrated with us in a seminar because we were too stiff. And he was showing the flow he was looking for. And then he stopped us and he was frustrated because he said, "Now you're all spaced out and sloppy." And he was trying to convey what he was looking for, and he said, "I want to see you're noble. I want to see you're awesome. I want to see you're shiny." So that's a little quick centering we could do. We could invite a little more noble, which is the uplift, a little more awesome, which is the openness, and a little more shiny, which is that warmth and softness. So I'm going to take a stop here and see if anyone has any questions or comments on anything that I've said this evening. Yes?
You were talking about judgment as a way of keeping yourself safe.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like self-judgment is a way of keeping me safe.
Right. Yes. I think it's not that it makes sense or skillful, our neurosis. It's just developed because if we can judge ourselves, then there's a sense that we have a way that it could be right. And maybe we orient it around we're not right. Like if I'm judging other people, I have a sense I'm right and they're wrong. If I'm judging myself, then I have a sense that I'm not good. Still, that's an orientation. I'm not good. And if I orient around that, it's basic psychology, right? If we grow up in an abusive situation, people have heard this, then you're going to seek abusive partners because it feels familiar. And that way it's safe, it's familiar. If we're used to judging ourselves, we're accustomed to feeling that we're not good, we begin to orient around that. It creates a feeling of safety because it's familiar. And if all the judgment were to suddenly go away, it would be wonderful on one hand, but on the other hand, it would be scary. So, you know, homeostasis. So homeostasis is the tendency that we want to keep things the same. Humans, we're not great at change. And I asked my neuroscience friend once, why, if the change is obviously good, would we resist it? And she said, the limbic system, which is the body, is still on the savanna. It's 2 million years older than the neocortex. And the body's view is, if you're not being eaten by the lion, don't change your behavior. You're alive. It's good enough. If you change your behavior, you'll be destabilized for a while until the new behavior kicks in. And during that time, you might not be able to outrun the lion. So the body thinks it's dangerous to change, even positive change. The mind thinks it's a great idea. Change. Right? Eat well, get the right amount of sleep, do this or that. Our minds understand. And yet we don't do it. Because our bodies are on a different program. So in that way, it makes sense that self-judgment would still create security because it's familiar. Does that help?
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, please.
I didn't get the name of the fellow who did Stardust.
Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's wonderful. He talks about universes and galaxies and how we're all connected. He has a great sense of humor. He's very lively. For an astrophysicist, they're usually kind of heavy, and he's funny and bright and wears crazy clothes, and yeah. Anything else? Really? You bought all that hook, line, and sinker?
Oh, no. Thank you. Yeah, I just want to say thank you for reminding us about the posse. I have several of your cards. A few in my kitchen, some near the television.
Nope. You can get another one or two there.
But I forget to use them as the posse.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful that you're here at all and all that you're saying, but to reconstruct in my mind that practice of I can call in the energy. I mean, I have my own practice about it, letting the universe come to me. I deserve some relief from suffering. But calling up those specific qualities from this person who you really admire, like, oh my God, no, the woman, Maya,
yep.
Who doesn't love Maya.
Who doesn't love her,
yeah.
Yeah.
And the quote from Muhammad Ali, you know, the will needs to be stronger than the skill. So thank you very much for that.
Well, you're very welcome. And you're right. I mean, all of this takes discipline because the habit is I do it. My granddaughter years ago, when she was about 3, liked to put on like multiple shirts, and she got stuck in the 3rd shirt and she was screaming, and I went to help her. She goes, no, I do it myself. And I thought, oh, and so it starts. We somehow are convinced we have to do it all ourselves. It's just not the case. And it takes discipline, wakefulness, awareness, to remember to do it. Because we get amnesia and go back to old ways of being, homeostasis. And so to wake ourselves up, you know, about the Buddha, after he got his enlightenment, people came to him and said, what are you? Are you an angel? Are you a devil? Are you a god? And he said, I'm awake. So we need to find ways to wake ourselves up throughout the day, not just a morning sit, which I recommend to everybody, of course, and or an evening sit, but throughout the day, how do we do that? Those of us who are tied to our devices, they can be very helpful, actually. We have a centering app, not that you have to use our app, but there's plenty of them. But you can set it. And I have it so 7 hours out of the day, my phone goes zzz, and it's just time to center, and I just do a little noble, awesome, shiny, or if no one's around. And it changes my energy. Change your energy, it changes the chemicals that are being released, and it changes your brain. I don't know about you, but I've always had a hard time changing my mind with my mind. It hasn't worked out very well for me. If I change the energy, which changes the chemicals. So when I feel tight, when I'm triggered, cortisol is released. And what cortisol does is it shuts down the creative part of our brains, big picture thinking. And it makes us feel separate and isolated, and then we have to manage each other. We have to use strategies. So if we can open up a little bit, we get different chemicals. If we lighten up and we think of something that makes us smile, we get oxytocin. It's the connector chemical. It makes us feel connected instead of isolated. When we expand and we open up, we get a little testosterone. It makes us feel a little bit bigger and more open. And we don't want too much of that. That's why we want the oxytocin, because too much testosterone can be annoying. We do need some of that confidence in that big picture. If you want to have a voice, you need to make yourself bigger. Size matters. Not the size of your bicep, but the size of your spirit. If you pull your energy in and make yourself small, you will not have a voice, except when we're having a voice criticizing ourselves. We'll have that voice. But we won't have a voice in the world. The problem today, in my view, is that the big people are often bullies. I want to go down on record for saying that we can be big and warm, compassionate, wise. But we're going to have to practice being big because for some reason we pull our energy in. And I think we do it to try to protect ourselves. Neuroscience has this term of peripersonal space. And what they've said is that our brain tends to map everything within our reach as us. So my brain thinks this is me. My brain thinks my family is part of me. I can be halfway across the world and call, and suddenly they're with me. But I go to the store, and people become other. I go to a meeting, and the person becomes other. I may like them and be nice to them, but they're other. The practice is, from a Sangha point of view, is to do the effort, the work, so that people are not other. So our brain starts to map everyone, certainly in our Sangha. And then if we really wanted to do practice, we'd map annoying people as part of us. They're annoying, they're unpleasant, but we'd still practice having the experience we're in this together. Doesn't mean we like their behavior. It's like good parenting. We cannot like what the child does. We always want to love the child. Does that make sense? So the problem is, though, we've been culturally trained to make people other, except our significant others in our family. As soon as they're other, then we have to manage them. We have strategies, control, approval, safety. When we're using those strategies, it's tiring. I want you to like me, but not too much. A little bit more. Oh, that was too much. Constantly trying to get the right amount of approval. It takes a lot of energy, and we lose our resilience. If we can practice, and places I like to practice are grocery stores. I'm in a grocery store, and I just expand my personal space and imagine that those random people in line are in my space. I have a big bubble, and they get to be inside it. If I'm in a restaurant, random tables next to me, I just practice. So I'm in the habit of including other people instead of they're other people. And then it's easier to do when I'm in a difficult conversation or when I'm looking at the news. Instead of making people other, I don't like the behavior. I want to remember we're in this together. I want to think they're part of me. Like a misbehaving child. It's not easy, and it's a practice. But if we don't do it all the time and we don't use our posse, we're not going to grow spiritually. And I think we're here because we all have some kind of commitment to grow spiritually. Yes?
I'm glad you mentioned your family because my posse is more personal than yours. I remember my grandmother, my great aunt, friends who passed, and I always feel their encouragement and their support and their strength, their courage. But also, this is really odd, I had a boss I couldn't stand 40 years ago in New York, and she became my negative role model. And to this day, if I feel myself acting like her, or if I see some of her energy coming out, I can say, you don't want to be like that. Look at all the damage you caused. Mm-hmm. So I have like a negative posse and a positive posse. But she keeps me in line when I want to lash out or when I want to say something nasty or if I don't want to be encouraging. I think of her and say, you don't want to be like her.
That's great. Thank you for that. Can I take that and use it?
Sure.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, we call them worthy opponents.
That's so much nicer.
Go whatever you want. But the principle is great. It's like there's always two ways to learn what to do and what not to do.
The day she quit her job, she was the boss of a lot of people, and I had already moved to California, but the day she resigned, everyone from that company called me and said, we're having a big party, I have to fly in. And I said, I can't fly in, but she's with me all the time because I take her as my role model of what not to do.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that. I love it. And it doesn't have to be famous people. I have clients who use their pets because this one gentleman is particularly, he's German and he's particularly self-critical. And his whole team, every time he walks in the room, they're just like, ugh, because they know that there's going to be lots of criticism. And he didn't want to be that way, just a habit again. We have these habits of behaviors. But when he talked about his dogs, he would always, just his face would light up. And he'd say, they're always glad to see me whenever I come home. And we go for a walk, and we've walked 1,000 times in this place, but it's always fresh to them. And as he's talking about his dogs, his whole, this happens, right? Instead of, hmm. And so I said, all right, your practice is before you go into the meeting room, get your phone out and look at your dogs for 20 seconds. Think about walking with them. Think about when you come home. Then go into the meeting with your team. His whole team came to me and said, thank you so much. Because it changed his energy. So it could be a family member. It could be a place. Some people have a place in nature. I sometimes use redwood trees because they're so elegant and strong and welcoming. And they've been burned and burned, the old ones, by fires, and they're still just growing. And they represent resilience to me. So I think about a redwood, and it makes me want to uplift a little bit more. It makes me feel a little more resilient. So I talk about famous people because it points to the principle. Definitely does not have to be famous people. The principle is, who or what can you think of that when you think of it changes your energy in a positive way, or in your case, in a worthy opponent? I think about her and I'm like, do not want to be like her. And in that way, we're reaching outside of our skin for these resources that really are us. I have Mother Teresa's compassion. I just need to contact it more. Instead of my reactivity. I have the Dalai Lama's wisdom. I just don't contact it often. I have Nelson Mandela's courage. The idea is to touch it more, contact it more. And when we do that, we start realizing over and over again, if we do it, that is me too, and I'm both. I'm neurotic, and I'm also resilient and inspired. I'm both. And it's okay. The idea is to change the baseline from, it's a percentage game. How much time are we spending in our personality trying to manage our life, trying to get things to happen, feeling frustrated, versus how much time do we feel inspired, uplifted, compassionate, energized? So if we could change the baseline a little bit so we have more percentage time in our inspirational self, our light, bright, shiny self. And of course we're still going to dip into our reactive selves. It never goes away. At least I've never seen it, short of a lobotomy. It's always there. And it's our compost and our humanity. It's just how much time are we spending there in any given day. And we could take it upon ourselves to change the baseline a little bit, to do some practices, to remember, find ways to wake ourselves up, whether it's using our devices, putting pictures around, having people that we know and trust remind us. When my kids were younger, my grandkids do it some now too, but I'd say, if you see me start to lose it, remind me. And they were like, ha. But it didn't make any difference, because when they would remind me, I would shift, and then they would see my shift. And they started realizing that is a good thing. Any other questions or comments?
Well, I found it very helpful, the way you talk about changing energy, because I have practice. And when you were talking, made me realize changes my energy. My practice is like self-metas. In other words, when I see, you're walking down the street saying meta for someone randomly. And I found over the years of doing this, I'll say meta for people particularly that I feel judgmental about, or I envy. And I realized lately, I do it automatically.
Yes.
As soon as the judgment kicks in, they go boing, and I'll do the reactive way.
That's fantastic. So you probably took you a few thousand times to do that, huh?
It took me a while. Yeah. Now I only can do it to my near ones and dear ones.
Yeah. And you will. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, depending on the stats, some people say 3,000 repetitions, 5,000, 10,000, to be able to change a habit. And then it's 100,000 to make it so it's very natural. But with 3,000 to 5,000, you can be able to catch it a little bit more when you're stressed. Because it's when we're all good, we're all good, and then we get stressed and we forget and we fall into these old habits of how we are when we're stressed. So we need to get some new habits so when we notice we're stressed, we can kick in just as you're saying. But if it only takes 10 seconds or 5 seconds, you'd be just a little more noble, a little more awesome, a little more shiny. Right? We're not looking for a half an hour. Looking for 20 seconds, 10 seconds. 1 second, ding, just pop, brighten up. And then that can start to shift the way the brain operates. And the brain starts to see possibilities and compassion and so on. Thanks for sharing that. That was great. I love it. Anything else before we close?